It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Immigration has become such a divisive subject, and not only in the U.S., but it's getting harder and harder to sort out what's political posturing and what's actual fact. So maybe it's time to take a step back and talk about how we talk about immigration. Because while we debate the numbers, everyone who tries to cross a border has their own individual story. And they are not all the same.
I remember going to the music institute and not knowing if I will make it back home because of the mortars and the horror we were experiencing. To me, as I was 23, I had a great ambition to be able to find my way out of Syria. I didn't want to be killed in such a way. I wanted to have a future. I wanted to come here to be able to help others who are in need in Syria. My name is Mariella Shaker. I'm a violinist from Aleppo, Syria. When I was junior, I went to London for an audition for the Master of Music program, and I was accepted. But sadly, the war prevented me from doing so. So I kept searching for another opportunity.
Eventually, Monmouth College in Illinois accepted Mariella into its music program. But first, she had to get there.
When I was about to leave Syria, I needed to catch up my flight from Beirut to the U.S. All the roads from and to Aleppo were closed. So we were advised to go to a certain area in Aleppo where there are a lot of buses, but they are not affiliated with any company. And it's going to be on your own risk. We went very early, about 7 a.m. We were the first people to go on that route. And it's shocking to me to see along the way, while we were leaving Aleppo, everything is destroyed, going back to nothing. So it was just hard. It was a very dangerous road, over than 50 checkpoints along the way. They thought the violin is a gun. I had to always open it and prove it's not. The bus driver got lost, and we were very scared. A couple of times I cried on that way. First, because I know it's probably the last goodbye with my mom, who accompanied me on the way. And second, because I did not know if I will make it to Beirut. It was very scary. We were not allowed even to take water with us. When I arrived to Beirut, it was a relief. It's kind of moving from hell to heaven. That moment I realized, oh, wow, we made it. I feel safe. It was the first step to achieve my dream to come to the U.S. And I was so glad to be able to be there. But at the same time, I was very, very sad. I was compelled to say goodbye to my mom. The moment we were at the airport in Beirut, it was a very sad moment. And my mom told me that she believes in me so much and I will be able to be successful there. Just about 2 days ago, my family was survived mortars falling. I was talking with them on the phone when it hit our place, the line was cut off and I could not connect with them for 2 hours after that. Sometimes I just go on Facebook, I scroll down. I just fear that I will hear any bad news about them. The US has opened a lot of wonderful doors for my career and they saved my life, and I'm truly grateful for this experience. It's just sad to be living here, but your heart is still there.
Mariella Schacher came to America in 2013. She gave her debut recital at the Kennedy Center 2 years later. Today, she's a professor of violin at Monmouth College, and she performs all over the world. When we talk about immigration in this country, at least right now, it's all about walls on the southern border. So how are other countries talking about immigration? Maybe we have something to learn from them. In Europe, migration has become the defining political issue for many countries. It's overturned governments, fueled the Brexit debate, and left in doubt the future of millions of migrants from the Middle East and Africa. Wolfgang Munchau is a columnist for the Financial Times. He's a native of Germany who now lives in England and writes about European politics. And he recently stopped by our studio to chat with Steve Paulson.
Wolfgang, there is a lot of debate about immigration in the U.S., but it can be hard to tell at times how much this is political posturing and how much it is actually an urgent problem. Now, you cover European politics. How central is immigration to political debates there?
It's very central to political debates there, and I agree with you. It's the same dilemma. To which extent is it an actual problem, and to which extent is it a perceived problem? And the two get mingled up at some times.
Is this mainly right now because of the refugee crisis in the Middle East and in Africa?
That was certainly what they called the immigration crisis of 2015. That was the famous period when Angela Merkel opened the German border, which is a slight misrepresentation of what happened. But in essence, the EU allowed a very large number of immigrants to pass through Eastern Europe into Germany, as opposed to the normal rules in the EU is that refugees do not pass through other countries. They stay in the country of first arrival.
So in other words, if you are sitting on the Mediterranean right across from the Middle East or from Africa, a country like Italy,
yes,
you are going to get more refugees. And you are
right.
Legally bound to actually take them in.
That's right. And that was the special situation of 2015 when Merkel decided to take in refugees who just passed through other countries and went into Germany.
So is this pretty much true across Europe that immigration is a huge political issue right now?
The 2015 stream of people was a big issue. It affected virtually all the countries. France decided not to take up any or very few immigrants in those years. But Germany did, Sweden did, Denmark did, sort of many of the northern countries did, and they suddenly realized that they were not able to handle the flow of immigrants. So these were clearly issues of a sudden large-scale immigration that overwhelmed the political system. I mean, we've seen this in Germany, where Merkel opened the borders, but she didn't prepare the country.
What should she have done?
Well, she could have made money available. I mean, if you make a decision that would ultimately lead to a million people coming into your country, you will have needed to build refugee centers.
In other words, they could come into the country, but there was no place for them to go.
There was no backup, exactly. There were temporary, makeshift accommodations. They used gymnasiums and schools, and so many public facilities were used to house immigrants temporarily. The police was not prepared for that. The German police was underfunded already.
And why did you need police?
There was a rise in crime. There was one German city where a student was murdered. Then the same city had gang rapes by refugees. We've had a disturbing story right in the first year from the city of Cologne, where a very, very large group of immigrants accosted pretty much the women in this entire area. And the police was not equipped to deal with the situation. And they were also politically very cautious because any involvement or any, you know, you didn't want to be accused of being anti-immigrant and rounding up the usual suspects. So the country was not prepared for this. And the same, even the news media, the public sector radio stations and TV stations decided not to report it because they didn't want to stir up any conflict. So it became sort of a form of self-censorship. And then the whole thing, when it was reported, the whole thing blew up in the opposite direction. And people then made the opposite and, you know, quite wrong inferences that, you know, immigrants are violent criminals and they must be locked up or stopped from entering the country.
So is this part of the reason why Angela Merkel then lost a lot of support in Germany, as she was seen as too friendly to immigrants? She was seen as being mistaken about opening up the borders?
Yeah, I mean, any politician who's been in office for such a long time, you don't have that problem in the United States. But if politicians are in power for more than 8 years, they make mistakes. Margaret Thatcher has had was let down by the famous poll tax. And Angela Merkel, that was her mistake.
So let's just touch on some of the major countries in Europe and just talk briefly about how immigration is affecting these countries. Now, we've been talking about Germany, France. Now, you said that France, at least in the height of the refugee crisis in 2015, basically closed their borders. They didn't allow them in. So has this not been such an issue for France?
Well, France has had immigration for much longer and for much more than Germany. I mean, France has a lot of immigrants from Northern Africa. And therefore, France decided they were politically not able to do this. It was clearly not politically accepted in France to open the borders, and the French had pursued by far the toughest lines. There is a lot of hypocrisy when France criticized Italy when the new Italian government came in and they basically shut the borders, France criticizing Italy for something they had done themselves.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about Italy, which was in the crossfire here about this huge immigration debate, because there was a flood of immigrants coming into Italy, and partly because of these laws from the European Union that they were required to take them in because the refugees often were landing on the Italian shore. So how many immigrants came to Italy?
During the height of the crisis, there were in the hundreds of thousands. The problem for Italy is not the total number. The problem is the total number arriving on a particular day. That's when the system can't cope. The systems in Europe are certainly able to cope with average large numbers, but the peak arrivals were the problem. And there were days when the situation, when it became politically not sustainable, when there were thousands and thousands, like 10,000 people arriving on your shores on a day where the system, you know, imploded.
This really caused a huge upheaval in Italian politics.
Yes, it did. Absolutely. The previous governments had tolerated the situation and tried to put a lid on this. But then, this became the main issue, one of the main issues in the previous election, the last election campaign. Two parties who were particularly outspoken about the subject.
Two far-right parties.
Well, one of them, the Lega, is certainly on the far right. Five Star, it's not clear whether they're on the far right or on the far left. They're kind of both. I mean, they seem to be more of a party. I would more classify them a party of the left than of the right.
Hmm. Although usually you think of a party on the left as being open, friendly to immigrants, and that's not the case here.
It depends on how you define it. I mean, we've seen in Germany the far left is very hostile to immigrants. So I think the immigration issue cuts through political affiliations.
Hmm. Let me mention one other major country in Europe, although some question about how European it is, the UK, of course, with Brexit, is sort of to some degree pulling out of the EU. And it would seem that immigration was the big issue in the Brexit vote, right? I mean, the referendum was approved to leave the EU because of immigration.
Yes, but one has to be careful by using the word immigration. When the Germans and the French and Italians talk about immigration, they talk about immigration from outside the EU. When the British talk about immigration, they talked about immigration from inside the EU. This is generally not classified as immigration. We call it, in the rest of the EU, we call it freedom of movement. It's not immigration. If a German citizen lives in France, that's a different category. That's part of the deal.
So the Brits basically, I mean, the people who voted for Brexit, they just didn't want all these people, people from other parts of Europe.
Generally, the experience in Europe has been, in all the countries, that, Europe needs immigration. Europe can handle immigration. But if too much happens in a too short a period of time, then you run into political problems. So we have in Europe a tendency to open our borders, but not to follow up. We are very bad with follow through.
So given how immigration has permeated the politics of really all these countries that we've been talking about, does this put in jeopardy the whole notion of Europe? Of Europe as sort of this unified political and economic entity. Is that at risk now because of immigration?
Yes, it is, because Italy, for example, says that if the countries of Eastern Europe refuse a quota system, because Italy demands a quota system, it wants refugees shared between EU countries on a quota according to size, GDP, population, whatever. But this has been rejected by a large number of countries, especially in the East. They oppose quota systems. They don't want any refugees at all.
Well, and we've heard of countries like Hungary and Poland have been very resistant to immigrants.
Very clear on this point. Italy is now saying that if you don't take the refugees, we will not approve the EU budget. And we certainly not approve a budget that has you as a net recipient, as you have been over the last, since you joined, essentially. So there will be conflicts coming in to the EU that arise directly from the immigration crisis.
Now, we've been talking about immigration as if it's just a huge problem for all of these countries. I mean, there is another argument to be made that actually the vitality of a country comes from its immigrants. They bring fresh energy, new people, different perspectives. Are we seeing that in Europe?
Well, you see this in the long run. You can say that both the UK and Germany and the Netherlands, we all benefited greatly from immigration. Germany would, without immigration, the German population, we would have entered a period of demographic decline that would have been extremely difficult to manage, especially when you have the kind of social systems that we have. They pay, pay-as-you-go pension systems would almost have been impossible to fund without the rise of immigration. So the long-term impact of immigration on society is generally positive. The issue isn't that. The issue is short-term peaks that countries find hard to manage.
Mm-hmm. Do you see immigration as just this dominant issue in European politics for years, maybe even decades to come?
I'm not sure it is. You may find that a change in leadership in Germany, which is imminent, Angela Merkel will certainly retire until 2021 at the latest, possibly earlier, depending on how long the coalition lasts. She will be replaced by another politician, and there are several candidates, but whoever emerges from this contest will be more conservative than she is on immigration. In the long run, I fear immigration streams from Africa that would dwarf anything we've seen so far.
Oh, really? So you think there might be many more immigrants
coming?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, the numbers are very, very large. We're talking about millions of refugees per year. So we're talking about numbers that the EU has not seen. And these are purely demographic factors. And if there's political instability in Northern Africa, unless there's some kind of economic stability recovery occurring in Africa.
Which African countries in particular are you talking about?
These are mostly North African countries, all the way down to Nigeria. I mean, there is a general increase in the populations there. I know of warnings from African scholars who are saying that they expect a demographic time bomb with large immigration into the EU. These are numbers that you can no longer control through patrol boats once you're dealing with millions. We do not have the infrastructure to handle that.
Wolfgang Munchau is a columnist for the Financial Times, and he was talking with Steve Paulson. So here's another thing we never seem to talk about when we talk about immigration. Could you imagine a world without borders? We'll talk about that next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about what's missing in our debates over immigration today. So much of the conversation right now is about borders and how to police them. But what if there was another way?
My dangerous idea is that borders are a thing of the past.
This is artist and activist Molly Crabapple.
What we're seeing now with the Syrians and the Afghans risking their lives to come to Europe is about war and it's about poverty, but it's not just about that. It's about something else, something bigger. We live in a time when we can communicate with anyone in the world. In our hands, we hold phones that have the sum total of human knowledge that give us this Gnostic and bodiless power to see anywhere and speak to anyone, regardless of borders. And yet, our identities are chained more than ever to borders. We in the first world, we with the lucky blue passports, we carry passports that have chips in them. Everything about us is tracked. Borders are these spaces that are so militarized. And it's all about dividing the rich world from the poor world. But the thing is that in a time when people's minds can go anywhere, people's bodies cannot be chained in this way. People will no longer respect the idea that borders were sacrosanct. And in fact, the idea of a border being sacrosanct is a very, very, very modern invention. So, let's say you're someone like a young Syrian engineer that I met in a refugee camp in Iraqi Kurdistan. He speaks English, he's highly educated, he fought for an education against all odds because he's part of a persecuted ethnic group and he got that education, has a good job, and then war comes and strips everything from him. And him and his whole family are living in a tent or in a shack in this expanse of dusty tents and shacks, and there's no future available for them. ISIS is maybe like 50 miles away, but even if they're technically safe, there's just nothing for them. There's nothing, you know? And this person, they have skills. They speak English. They speak like a bunch of languages. They had a future that was in mind for them. They have a young sister that wants to be a doctor. They have all of this ambition and potential and talent, and they're stuck in this camp with nothing because of the book of paper they hold.
You look at what's marching up, that's an invasion. That's an invasion.
How can you tell someone like that not to get on a boat to Europe? How can you tell someone like that because of the spot of land that you were born on or because of the mother you came from or whatever, you have less of a right to human dignity, to free movement and happiness than someone else? Just by virtue of the fact that you were born on a poor spot of land and I was born on a rich spot of land. Anyone who fundamentally believes that humans are created equal must deeply question the idea that citizenship to certain countries, to certain rich countries, has to grant you privileges. Anyone who believes that humans are created equal has to look at the Afghans and the Syrians, the families, the men, the women, the little kids that are paying $2,000 to smugglers because they're not allowed to go on a death boat, because they're not allowed to buy plane tickets because they come from poor countries, and then look at the own freedom with which they travel the world, a freedom that's totally born from coming from an empire, and think, my God, there is something wrong here.
That's artist and activist Molly Crabapple. So, I don't know. A world without national borders sounds radical, futuristic, maybe incredibly naive. But Parag Khanna is a hard-headed global strategist, and he believes that borders are already becoming irrelevant, eroded in our increasingly interconnected global world. He told Steve Paulson it's time to redraw the world map.
Borders are really just one type of line on the map, and in fact, they are mostly ghosts. At a day-to-day level, what shapes our lives more and more is infrastructure, by which I mean transportation, energy, communications, railways, highways, pipelines, electricity grids, internet cables. And by and large, more and more borders around the world are being transcended and paved over, literally, by all of this infrastructural connectivity. And yet most of our maps, no matter what country you're in, tend to just show the standard Rand McNally kind of, you know, atlas of the world that just has political boundaries.
Okay, so give me some sense. If we can do this on the radio, I know maps are visual, but draw me a couple of alternative maps about how the world actually works.
Right. Perfect. Let's start right here at home. The United States is a major consumer of Canadian natural resources. And in fact, that is the most heavily transited border for trade in the entire world. You can draw that. You can visualize that. You can create a moving map, if you will, of all of the trucks and all of the pipelines and all of the oil and gas flows and so forth that are actually transcending that border every day.
There's so many ironies here because politicians are obsessed with borders these days. I mean, of course, this is, you know, what immigration policy is all about. You're saying that's mostly irrelevant?
It's irrelevant in multiple ways. It's irrelevant because it's wrong, right? It's factually wrong. The arguments that are made about the necessity of borders because they are based on, you know, sort of faulty data around, you know, what we are actually preventing. They ignore all of the good things and all of the ground reality. So if you look at border demographics, you see populations growing along borders, like the US-Canada border, like the US-Mexico border, like the India-Pakistan border, like the Norway-Russia border. I point to border after border to show that how come all, if we're supposed to be hostile towards our neighbors, then why are people moving towards borders? Because they want to be near markets. They want to be able to trade. They want to be near thriving cities. And those people don't care what side of the border it's on. The border is a friction. The border is a hindrance. The border is an obstacle that gets in their way.
And yet borders are what define countries, right? And as far as I can tell, the governments of the United States, Russia, China, the EU, you know, go down the line, they still wield enormous power. I mean, they wage wars, they make trade alliances, they build infrastructure, they do all kinds
sure.
of things.
I'm not saying that you will cast off the shackles of your national identity and that, you know, states and borders don't matter. I would never say that. I'm saying they're one layer. And again, think of history as sort of evolution and archaeology. We've had cities and empires and nations rising and falling for millennia. And what we're doing now is building so much connectivity between the major urban cities and population centers of the world that we're evolving beyond just thinking of ourselves as nations and states and borders towards a connected civilization of infrastructure and supply chains.
In my sense is, I mean, your argument is that to some degree, the nation state is becoming less important. The city is becoming more important, especially the megacity, these huge cities
yes.
that sort of become you know, entities unto themselves.
They already are, first of all. So this is not science fiction. Most countries in the world, most of the time today, rest on the pillar of one city that is not only the most important city in their national economy, but is a regional sphere of influence unto itself, like a Singapore or an Istanbul. So that city is not in any way constrained, if you will, by political boundaries. And in fact, if you look at the great cities of the world, they've existed for thousands of years, and their influence is totally regional, you know, like a London or of course, a New York or a Miami, a Paris, you know, and all of these places. Their identity or their role in the world is far beyond whatever country, you know, happens to sort of, you know, supervise them nominally any given time.
Well, it makes me wonder if instead of, you know, the G20 or, you know, these global get-togethers of, you know, major nations, maybe there should be an alliance of global cities that come together.
Absolutely.
Because you're suggesting that's where the real action
and
is.
And that wouldn't be new either. I write in this book about the Delian League of ancient Athens. I write about the Hanseatic League of Northern Europe in the Middle Ages. And what my wish for the 21st century is to have far more what I call diplomacity, you know, diplomacy among cities. Cities think so differently than countries think, and they think in a far more positive sum, mutually beneficial, commercially oriented, peaceful and tolerant way. And, you know, again, we only have all of our own histories of mankind as evidence of what I just said.
So play this out for me then. I mean, if there were this connectivity between particular cities, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you see that? I mean, sort sort of draw the map again for like particular cities that are connected to each other?
It's already the case. Every global city, by definition, is a connected city because that's part of what generates your value. Dubai became Dubai not because it has a large population. It only has, you know, 3 or 4 million people. But its airline connects to every major city in the world nonstop because of its geography. It's not a military threat to anyone. It's not even the capital of its country. But it has entered the ranks of the most connected cities in the world, and that's what makes it relevant. This is how cities think. We should want the world to move in this direction, and fortunately, it is.
I want to come back to your example of Singapore, one of the places where you now live. I mean, you said it's, in some ways it's a model city, and yet I also hear it, there's kind of this authoritarian streak. You got to be careful about what you say. You can't really criticize the people in power. And I guess I'm wondering about the politics of all of this. I mean, you know, if we're tying so much of sort of our model of how the world works to GDP, I mean, what about other issues like freedom of speech, inequality, basic human rights?
Mm-hmm. We're not tying the model of how the world works to GDP. But that said, you know, if you think about the role of connectivity on rights and freedoms, you don't exactly expect a country like Turkmenistan to liberalize unless you're going to connect to it, right? Unless you're going to have more flows of information and trade and exchange. You can talk about it and badmouth it if you want to, but it's never really going to evolve in a modern direction, in a liberal direction, unless it's connected. Less connected societies have less of a stake in a peaceful international system. And so if you want to change North Korea, you want to change Iran, you want to change Russia, you can either threaten it or you can connect more to it. And that is a very, very concrete argument that I make.
Now, my impression is your analysis comes a lot out of your own life. You have lived in all kinds of cities in lots of different continents. And, you know, you talk about, you know, you've lived in Singapore, New York, London. I mean, it's as if you're
Berlin. Too.
I mean, it's almost
what a great city.
If you're not that attached to any particular country, it's like, you know, people talk about being the global citizen or the cosmopolitan citizen. I mean, you're it. It sounds like.
Well, I suppose, but I mean, I don't view identities as being in competition. You know, I mean, I don't see why we should think about the 21st century as being wedded to the same ideological shackles as the 17th century. I mean, if you choose to see the world that way, that's your choice. But the world I'm living in and talking about, I'm not alone in, because there are 300 million people today who live outside of their country of origin. There are 300 million expats. And by the way, there are more American expats than ever in history. There are 9 million Americans living outside the United States. You know, you can have multiple identities today. The notion that they have to be exclusive to each other is just a very terrible ideological figment of one's, you know, historical imagination.
Well, it makes me wonder if national borders are going to become less and less important. Are we moving back to the city state, the thing that, you know, used to be around millennia ago?
Well, I'm very glad you used, you know, the sort of the historical reference and said back to, because for thousands of years, the city has been our dominant sort of unit, if you will, of sociology and obviously infrastructure and even politics to some degree. Again, modern nation states are just a couple of hundred years old, and most of them are really just a century old. Most of the countries in the world today were born after 1945. And I don't just mean most of them. I mean two-thirds of them. And as you can see in the Arab Spring, a lot of them really aren't going to last that long, right? So we have to remember the way, you know, what our actual story is, not what our theoretical story is, not what our international law tells us. We have to think about reality. And so we are already moving back to this sort of, you know, city state. And I think that's a very positive thing because, as I said earlier, cities want to prioritize connectivity. They cannot survive on their own. There is no autarky or self-sufficiency in a world of megacities. They thrive on relations with each other.
That's Steve talking with Parag Khanna. He's a global strategist and the author of Connectography. Coming up, the story of one undocumented immigrant and the price he paid to restart his life. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Right now, there are nearly 11 million undocumented immigrants living and working in the U.S. illegally. I want to introduce you to one.
My name is Jose Angel N., and I've been in Chicago for about 22 or 23 years. So I come from Guadalajara, and I came back in 1993. If you were to ask any Mexican back then what they will be doing with their lives when they came to the States, they will usually tell you, I'm going to go there, going to work a couple of years, come back, you know, with my money, I'm going to save it all. I'm going to open a small business, and that's what I'm going to live off of. That was my idea as well, but that didn't happen, obviously. I've held all different sorts of jobs. Like, you know, I remember working like one day in construction and then at the restaurant. Instead of being a dishwasher, I was promoted and I started working as a busboy. So instead of being in the kitchen, I was promoted to being in the dining room. And that's when, you know, I started knowing other people, kids who went to college and then came back. So I started watching these kids that will go off to college and then come back. And, you know, I saw them and I didn't think they were that different. And I was like, okay, if they can do this, maybe I can do it too. So I went to a community college, and those books opened a whole new universe that I never knew about before, because I had never had access to reading. And then it became an obsession. You know, somebody suggested that I should do a master's degree in Latin American literature. So I did. And doing my PhD right now is a continuation of that. But I didn't have any guidance. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew that it was something cool and unprecedented in the whole history of my family and in my life. And it was life-changing to me.
This is Clark and Link. Transfer to orange, green, and pink line trains.
So coming to school from home, I usually get on the red line, and then I transfer to the blue line. It's a commute that takes about just over an hour, about an hour and 15 minutes or so. Typically, I read. I mean, that's time that I have to use to read and catch up with my classes.
Doors closing.
Being undocumented marks every second of my life. There's not 1 minute that I don't think about it. There's a whole lot of things that happen to you. Like, I was not able to go out with co-workers, for instance, and have a drink because I did not have proper identification. So, you know, for me, it was like becoming invisible a second time, because, you know, being undocumented is already being invisible in a sense. But when you enter a different circle, when I enter the fairy tale of the American middle class, everybody assumed that I was documented, that nobody had any reason to believe that I was not. So it's the little things that you have to do on a daily basis that really get to you. Like whenever someone at work will mention something about an immigration rate somewhere, I will have to act all cool like nothing was happening. But deep inside, you know, I was feeling anxious and nervous that that will happen to me at any moment. So those are the sort of things that happen to me on a daily basis, among many others. You know, women talk about the glass ceiling. You know, I mean, in my case, it's a legal ceiling. And it was stigmatizing because, you know, I had gone through all the things that people who wanted to assimilate had to do. You know, they had to learn English, they had to learn about social values, American history, whatnot. So I'd done all that. But at the same time, you know, I was still not allowed to become part of this society, not a full member of this society. People need to keep in mind that when people like me work and have an employment, we pay taxes and we don't get any social benefits whatsoever. Many people, they call us criminals, they tell us that we're not immigrants to them. You know, to those people, we're not immigrants, we're criminals. So it makes me very upset, but I don't know how to put it, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but they think the laws and the books or abstractions are more valuable than the lives of human beings, flesh and blood.
So this is where I stay part of the week.
This is our living room. You know, these are my daughter's toys. That's the little horse that she loves, and her kitchen. It's my reading chair. It's been challenging, but I'm very grateful that it's been challenging for me. I mean, I look at my family, and there's not one moment that I regret. You know, I look at my wife and my daughter, and I think about the opportunities that I've had because I've worked so much and so hard and for so long, and I have gone to college, and those are opportunities I wouldn't have in Mexico. We're hopeful that at some point this has to change. Because right now, the way it is, I mean, people don't think that people like myself are full human beings. They call us illegal is for a reason. They see a morally inferior being in me. You know, you broke the law, you are morally inferior to me. So that kind of a stigma, you carry it all the time with you. So all of that would change. We will have our humanity vindicated again.
José Ángel N. is the author of Illegal, Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. We're talking about migration and borders today. And of course, crossing a border is just the beginning. For a lot of new immigrants, the process of transitioning to a new country is difficult, even dangerous.
The restaurant closed on Christmas Day, the one day in the year when it did. And Dodgy spent the morning lying on the floor, on the blue sofa cushions, gazing up at the damp ceiling. There was no point in looking for any work today. He'd learned that much from last year. Ardashir sat on his straight chair at the window. After a silence of almost 2 weeks, the older man spoke. How long are you staying here? I can leave now. In England, I said. Until I've earned enough. Then you're a fool. The afternoon was quieter still, and as they sat down with the lamb curry brought back from the restaurant the previous night, all that could be heard was the dull scrape of metal on foil and the slurp and slop of eating. Sometimes a car went by. You're a bigger fool than me. I didn't have anyone to tell me different. Dodgy said nothing. Take my advice and go back now, before there's nothing to go back for and you're stuck here. It was the most he'd ever said to Dodgy. Perhaps it was this Christmas spirit everyone went on about. 33 years. Didn't do my papa's rights, my BGs. Wife and children started new lives. For what? So I can sit here in this hell. No future but death. Just a body needing to be clothed and fed. Go back. You understand?
That's an excerpt from The Year of the Runaways by Sanjeev Sahota. The novel was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2015, and it tells the story of a year in the life of three recent immigrants. Sanjeev is from an immigrant family himself, although he was born and raised in the UK. And the novel is certainly timely, considering Europe's recent migration crisis, but Sanjeev says that's not why he wrote it.
People say to me, you've written a very topical or a timely book, and I kind of say, well, that's sort of incidental. You know, the base is very personal. It's immigration's at the root of me. And, you know, if it wasn't for immigration, I certainly wouldn't be a novelist or writing books or living the life I'm lucky enough to be leading. So immigration, I think, has always been there in my background. And because I go to Punjab in India annually, sometimes once or twice, you know, a year, I've been there twice already this year. These stories, this sort of desperate need to get to the West, I've been hearing them for 15, you know, 20 years. It was inevitable that they were going to find their way into my fiction, given my own background as well.
Well, let's talk about some of your characters. There are these three migrants, young men named Tochi, Avtar, and Randeep. Who are they, and when the book begins, what's their daily life like?
Yeah, so there's Randeep, who's 19 years old, and he's made his way to England via a visa marriage. So he's married someone for convenience, a woman called Narinda, and he's living in a house with 12 other men. And Randeep's quite immature. He's not really adjusting to life in England at all well. There's Avdar. He's over on the UK on a student visa, though he's got no intention of... Though he tries, his main priority is to just work, and though he...
Well, he's working two jobs.
He's working two jobs.
And the only way he got to England in the first place is he sold a kidney to get there.
Yeah, right. He sold his kidney, and then he also took out a massive loan from the loan sharks. And to pay those loans back, he takes on two jobs, because if he doesn't pay those loans back, his family's in danger back in India. And this is sort of the difficulties people find themselves into, and that they're willing to put themselves into, because they think the money that they earn in England will more than sort of cover their costs. It's like this Dick Whittington sort of esque thing of the streets will be paved with gold. But the reality when they get here is very different.
And then there's your third character, Dochi, who, unlike the others, he didn't come in order to try to make money and send it back to his family, because his family's gone.
You're right. For him, he's called a Jamar, a man from from the lower castes in India. And you're right, his family are killed in a caste massacre. And he comes to England as a way to sort of just to prove himself as a human being, that he has as much right to make his own decisions in life as anyone else. There's a scene in the book which means a lot to me, when someone who he's been working for realises that he's of a lower caste, and she says to him, you know, who are you? And he says, I'm a man. And I think for him, that's what the journey's all about.
So life is so difficult for your characters. You know, they've got this daily slog of backbreaking, incredibly insecure work. I mean, they show up every day not knowing, are they really going to have this construction job or not? They also live crammed into this tiny apartment. They are tightly bonded and, you know, really close companions to each other, but they're also competing against each other for jobs. I don't know. Is this, do you think, somehow characteristic?
When there's 12 men and there's one job and they're all desperate for that one job, it's everyone for themselves. And I think, as one of the characters, Godpreet, says, who's been in England for about 11 years, I think he says, the worst thing is that everything becomes a fight. Everything becomes a competition. Fight, fight, fight. Fight for the next job. And I think it changes them in a way. I have to say, over time, it does just, it makes them bitter. And your sense of what's normal, I think, changes.
How did you find out so much about what these young men's lives are? And what kind of research did you do to write the stories?
I go to India a lot. In that part of India I go to, which is very rural part of the state, these are stories that you hear, you know, in the bazaar, in around the temples. It's a very open conversation.
What does it feel like for you? Because I was thinking, it must be difficult to be going back and to feel like you live a life of such relative privilege simply because of where you were born. You know, and you're back talking to people who are suffering and living really, really difficult lives, also simply because of the accident of which country they were born in.
It is. It's deeply unfair. Whenever I go back to India, and it's interesting I say back, actually, given I was born in England, but whenever I go to India, it's a really live question inside me, that what do I owe? What, you know, for the children of immigrants in the UK like me, you know, what does it mean to be good? How is it fair that, as you said, just because I was born in one place, I can live one kind of life, and, you know, my cousins or, you know, people who are born in a different place, just because of a quirk of luck, really, aren't able to enjoy the same benefits that I can. And I can't really square that. I can't think of, for me, it's, you know, immigration, it's the basic question is a moral one. I don't think it's fair that I can live the life I can just because of something to do with luck. So that's, I suppose, my basic reason for believing that immigration is almost just a human right, really.
You said this is a question that lives inside of you, along with the question of what does it mean to be a good person or to live a good life, given those conditions. I mean, how do you answer that for yourself? Did you write this book out of a sense of responsibility?
I'm not sure I wrote it out of a sense of responsibility. I think once I decided I was going to write the story, I definitely felt a sense of responsibility to the people that I knew had gone through this life, you know, to honour it in a way. So once I decided I was going to write the story, there was definitely a moral dimension to how I tackled it, and the fact that I didn't portray the characters as either, You know, as either heroes or villains, I just portray them as people first and foremost, and they do awful things to each other. They're not saints in any sense, but hopefully it's understood through what they've gone through and what they're trying to achieve. Yeah, the question of goodness and what it means to be good to me, it's one I, you know, wrestle with. I have, you know, connections in India, and, you know, each time I go back, you're constantly being asked to help or to do something or to sponsor them or to speak to someone, and you do what you can within the bounds of legality, I guess.
Did writing this book teach you anything you didn't know about the migrant experience? I mean, what do you feel like you learned over the course of writing it?
Yeah, I think writing a book, it's always you start off with a set of questions. And so I started off knowing, you know, the whole topic of migration and immigration, and especially in this global world we live in, was complicated. And I think I've just finished the book realizing it's even more complicated than I thought. And if anything, I don't know if I learned, well, I suppose what I learned was just it's even more knotted than I thought.
Sanjeev Sahota. His novel, The Year of the Runaways, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. And that's it for this hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge. But there's always more online. Check out our articles and digital extras at ttbook.org. Our show is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Angelo Battista. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strangchamps. See you next time.